The Battle of Los Angeles, also known as the Great Los Angeles Air Raid, is the name given by contemporary sources to the rumored attack by Japan and subsequent anti-aircraft artillery barrage, which took place 78 years ago over Los Angeles. The incident occurred less than 3 months after the United States entered World War II in response to the Imperial Japanese Navy's surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. But what was it? Was it a weather balloon? Was it a false alarm? Was it a UFO? In a moment, Mike Barra joins us. We'll talk about that and some other UFO stories next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Mike Barra is a New York Times best-selling author. He is a lecturer, television personality. His books have sold more than 70,000 copies worldwide. He began his writing career after spending more than 25 years as an engineering designer consultant for major aerospace companies. He knows what he's talking about. He was a card-carrying member of the military-industrial complex, but he made the switch. Mike, welcome back. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, George. It's great to be with you.
I was in Denver doing my Beyond Belief TV show, so I was just mentioning it, and watching in my room Ancient Aliens, a little extravaganza, and I'm telling you, it was the Mike Barra night.
Yeah, that was the Men in Real Men in Black episode.
Yes, you were everywhere.
Yeah, I know. Well, and then I was there was some other show on Discovery about the Bermuda Triangle that I did the other that was on Sunday night too. So, you know, you just can't avoid me, George. I'm everywhere. I'm on, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Sometimes I'm on the whole week, every night of the week. It's great.
You're like a virus, but you're a good guy.
Well, am I a good virus or a bad virus? There are good viruses, right?
78 years ago today, the Battle of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
What the heck do you think happened?
Well, I can tell you what I think, and I can tell you what, you know, what the facts are around it.
Sure.
And I can also, I mean, I had a real long conversation this morning with our friend, our mutual friend, Sonia Grace. And
yeah.
Sonia and I talked about it, and I gave her all the evidence, and I said, I think it's aliens. And what do you and your friends up in the sky think? And she said, yeah, aliens. So, you know, we can get into that aspect of it once we kind of go through the whole thing, if you want, or we can just talk about it now.
Well, we're going to talk about a lot of stuff with you, including they're discovering heavy earthquakes on Mars these days. I want to get your take on that. But, yeah, let's get right into this thing. First of all, we were at war with Japan.
Right.
People were uptight, and we felt Japan might send some planes over, and the closest was the West Coast.
Yeah, it absolutely was. And, you know, at that point, there had been a few events that had already taken place. The not only, of course, the bombing of Pearl Harbor in December of 1941, but then we also had some incidents where the Japanese had actually invaded the Aleutian Islands along the Alaskan coast. And there was supposedly rumors of an aircraft carrier off the coast of San Francisco Bay, Oakland, around that time. And there was, you know, basically sort of a paranoia in the air. There were plans, and actually they were carried out. There were plans to actually, you know, black out the West Coast, Seattle, San Francisco, Portland, I guess, and Los Angeles, where they would black them out at night so that the Japanese couldn't get a good bearing on the cities and, you know, where the military facilities were. Of course, you know, up in Seattle here, we had Boeing, which at that time was probably furiously working on building B-17s and B-29s and anything they could get in the air to fight the Japanese. And, of course, we had an entire Pacific fleet, you know, except for the aircraft carriers that we had to rebuild that had been sunk at Pearl Harbor. So there was all these reasons why the Japanese were going to be after us. And then there had been a whole bunch of attacks on merchant shipping. I mean, there were some ships that were damaged. The USS Camden was sunk. The Larry Doheny was sunk. So there was about, I think, almost a dozen different episodes of Japanese submarines and Japanese warships attacking American merchant ships in the Pacific up to that point. So, you know, by the time the weekend or the week rolled around of February 23rd, 24th, things were pretty crazy. And in fact, it turns out that on the 23rd, the day before this famous incident, At about 7:15, at the same time that Franklin Roosevelt was giving a fireside chat, a Japanese submarine surfaced right off the coast of Santa Barbara.
Jeez.
And shelled an oil field there near a town called Goleta. So there wasn't a lot of damage, but it was pretty unnerving to people. I mean, I think we felt probably more vulnerable as a country than we had felt at maybe any time in our history.
In this Battle of Los Angeles, as they were shooting at something, did anybody die during this episode?
Oh yeah, actually there were five deaths at least that are attributed to the shelling, and most of it is because, you know, they think that there was just anti-aircraft artillery firing all over the place.
So it was just falling on people and
it
stuff like that.
It was fire. Yeah, there's actually one. You know, on the news, the newspapers are really hard to come by. They're not very high resolution, but there was one case where I was able to look at some of the captions of the photographs of the LA Times from the period of the a couple of days there. And there was one that actually somebody had a shell come right through the roof of their house way up near Crenshaw, between the 10 and the 110 and the 405. So that's way inland. That's over by Inglewood. And, you know, where downtown. So that was an incident where there were shells coming down there. And the interesting thing about that is it indicates that, you know, traditionally we tend to think of this thing as taking place kind of off the coast. But there was anti-aircraft stuff being fired in towards downtown L.A. at the same time, which is pretty extraordinary.
And apparently Naval Intelligence on the 24th of February talked about an attack could be expected within hours.
Yeah,
everybody was uptight.
Exactly, they did issue that event after some other things had happened. Especially, I think it was the submarine that had shelled the oil field the day before. So everybody was very, very tense.
I want to issue something to our listeners. This, of course, was 78 years ago, but if anybody was around then and you remember this episode, call us now. Get on the show. I want to pop you on with Mike Barra and just explain to us what's going on. That would have made you 80 or 90, maybe even 100 years old.
Yeah, pretty close to 100, right?
I'm not sure there are many people left there, Mike, but my gosh, if we can dig up one or two, what a story that would be.
Yeah, that would be a great show. Let's do that.
Now, weren't they pinging when they were shooting the artillery? People could hear things being hit?
Yeah, that's actually true. Also, there were multiple reports of the sound of like metallic, like the shells hitting something metallic. And again, it appears that as you go through the sequence of events, that there were multiple different incidents. Like there were planes sighted over the city, or what people thought were planes, but basically are just described as bright lights. And so, and then there was the main object, which seemed to sort of crawl down the coast there, right off the Pacific, right off the coast, that was hit multiple times. And when the people talk about the shells hitting that object, that's where you get these reports of just kind of a ping, ping, bouncing sound of being hit. And I mean, some of these shells, George, they were not small. I mean, there were 50 caliber machine guns.
Jeez.
Some of the anti-aircraft shells were these 12.8 pound shells. Imagine getting hit with that at, you know, hundreds of feet per second or thousands of feet per second velocity. For it not to take something down, it had to be dang near indestructible.
In the daytime, when the sun came out, where was the object?
It was gone by then. The firing actually ended about 4:14, 4:15 in the morning, when they kind of decided that the whole thing was over with, and they stopped firing all the different, you know, weapons and stuff, all the different aircraft batteries up into the sky. So it had stopped by then, but, you know, everything, the blackout order was lifted at 7:21, and the sun would have been coming up right around that time anyway.
Could anybody at night, with the lights that they were beaming up there, see anything?
Yeah, there were multiple reports, again, of different objects. There were people who described clusters of small objects flying around. They were described as airplanes. At least they're characterized as airplanes, but the descriptions don't really sound like airplanes. They were these small sort of fireflies that were zipping around the skies over L.A. Now, the descriptions on the speed of these objects was, you know, anywhere from, like, basically very slowly, like a crawl, which could be some sort of balloon, or, you know, over 200 miles an hour. So they weren't going super fast. And then, of course, there was the big main object, which ran all the way down the coast. And these things could be seen in the searchlights. And there's the very famous picture from the LA Times of the disc-shaped object with the dome on top of it. You know, there's about 9 spotlights on it, and there's anti-aircraft flak going off all around it, and it looks like a flying saucer sitting in those spotlight beams.
I mean, clearly there's something up there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the thing is, too, if you look at that picture, people say, okay, there's you know, people have tried to argue about that photograph, but the fact is that, look, there was something physical there that all 9 searchlights, spotlights, had spotted.
Exactly.
And followed. There's no way around it. There had to be something there, and what could possibly survive that kind of shelling for an extended period of time? I mean, for 3 or 4 hours, it's crazy.
Well, and if this happened to be a weather balloon, it would have got blown to smithereens, wouldn't
it? Yeah, there's no way that object, the main object, was a weather balloon. You know, George, it's really interesting. When you look at this case, it's almost like a parallel of the Phoenix Lights, in that you have these multiple different objects, one of them which kind of flies over the city, and then you've got the objects that were over the mountains that some people think are flares, and you've got the scrambled aircraft. So you've got different sightings taking place at different parts of the city, some of which could have been balloons, but that one, the main object, absolutely was not a balloon.
Who was the celebrity, Mike, who eventually saw this thing?
Well, actually, there were a couple who experienced it that is really, really interesting. One of the more interesting ones is DeForest Kelly, who later went on to play Dr. McCoy in the original Star Trek series.
Okay, sure.
He was not in the military yet. He was a young man, but you know, he lived in Los Angeles, tried to make a career as an actor. And he said that he saw the incident from Long Beach. Now, again, people have argued and said, okay, well, the main object didn't make it all the way down to Long Beach, but Kelly was in Long Beach. And what he said he saw was tiny white lights way up in the sky that looked like the formation of some sort, but they were at extremely high altitude. And people did describe some of these small objects up over around, you know, 12 to 20,000 feet. So he saw those objects down around Long Beach near the end of this whole process. And then John Wayne reportedly, you know, the film 1941 that Steven Spielberg made back in the 1980s.
Was that with Belushi?
Belushi. John Belushi was the star of that.
Yeah.
He actually, Spielberg had created a character for the movie called General Stillwell, and he wanted John Wayne to play it. And he gave the script to John Wayne, and Wayne said, forget it, I'm not doing this. It was nothing like that. And Spielberg said, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, I saw the whole thing.
Wow.
And I was around when those, he said fake bombs fell out of the sky. At least that's the quote. There was no panic in Los Angeles. There were some news reports on the radio, and that was about it. So according to John Wayne, it was not a big deal at all. But, you know, he was way up in Hollywood as opposed to being down, you know, Santa Monica, Long Beach, Redondo, Hermosa, down along the beaches there. He wasn't in that area. So Kelly apparently saw something pretty different down in Long Beach than John Wayne saw it in Hollywood.
How would you rate this, Mike, with War of the Worlds that Orson Welles played on CBS?
Well, I guess, you know, look, if you listen to War of the Worlds, I mean, it's terrifying. If you don't get right away that it's a play, it's terrifying to listen to. I can imagine that this probably was just as terrifying when it was going on, because imagine this, George, you've got the war jitters. You're under pressure.
You've been warned an attack is imminent.
You've been warned that there is an attack coming within the next 10 hours. A few hours later, the sirens go off. The city goes dark. All the power is cut off. The entire city goes dark, and all hell breaks loose over your head with every anti-aircraft battery cannon going off and machine gun fire, 50 calibers, small arms fire, I'm sure. At these objects, these small objects that are darting all over the place, possibly some balloons, which you don't know what those are. You don't know if those are Japanese balloons or American balloons or, you know, whose are they?
That's right.
And then you've got this big object, which is described as like a blimp. And that's the interesting thing about the photograph is it does look like a flying saucer-shaped blimp, but there's no way it could survive that bombardment. So imagine all this stuff going up. I think it would be be like War of the Worlds. It would be just as terrifying as that, thinking you're getting invaded at that moment by the Japanese.
Did we send, well, of course, we were firing a lot of artillery. I'm not sure if we sent any planes up there at the time, did we?
Well, we know we had planes on alert, but none of them actually went up in the air. And thank God they didn't, because they would have got shot down.
Oh, they would have got blown up, yeah.
By our own weapons. I mean, we were firing off all the anti-aircraft batteries, plus, you know, 50 calibers and everybody with their machine guns and stuff. So any planes that were up in the sky probably would have been knocked out, because, again, some of these shells and things and the people that were killed, they were all in the downtown area or Culver City or that area there. And so there was stuff being fired off all over the place. Think back about those videos from the Gulf War, the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War, where all the anti-aircraft stuff is going off over Baghdad. It's the same kind of thing. And imagine if you were a plane trying to fly through that at low altitude, you would have gotten creamed.
Shock and awe.
Yeah, exactly. Shock and awe. That's what it would have been like. It would have been unbelievable.
Now, there were rumors we had 500 military troops at Walt Disney Studios in Hollywood in Burbank. Is that true?
That is categorically true, yeah. In fact, they were stationed there because there was a lot of concern about the possibility that we would have, the Japanese would try to damage the studio, destroy it, kind of strike at the cultural heart of America. And, you know, create some damage. So, yeah, there were 500 troops there stationed, not just because it was a good place to garrison some troops, but they were there to actually protect the studios.
So these five people that were killed, they're minding their own business, and all of a sudden, what, shrapnel and pieces of the debris of the artillery falls right on them and crushes
yeah, it
them?
It would be shells. You know, what goes up must come down, and everything ultimately ballistic. And so, yeah, just stuff fired into the air. I mean, imagine you're sitting there in your comfortable house, you know, in Mar Vista or something, and a 12.8-pound shell traveling several hundred miles an hour crashes down into your house and stuff. So there was a lot of that. And I mean, five people actually, I think, is a pretty high number. You know,
it is.
Given the circumstances, it's pretty crazy that five people lost their lives. And that's what we know about, and that's what was reported at the time. And remember, we didn't have social media, we didn't have the internet, so it's probable that the reports are actually fairly conservative in terms of how many people actually lost their lives in the whole thing.
After the war, the Japanese government said, "We have flown no planes over Los Angeles during the war."
Yep. They categorically said that we did not have anything to do with this. It was not our aircraft. You know, whatever you guys were shooting at were not Japanese planes or any other kind of experimental aircraft or balloons or dirigibles or anything. So the question then becomes, you know, what was this big, heavy object that basically, and it, you know, George, the thing is, it was first spotted on radar 120 miles out.
Really?
Slowly moving towards Santa Monica, and then there were updates, and the alerts actually went off. Everything went crazy.
Why didn't we try to intercept it then?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. At the time, you have to remember, we were very unprepared and we were very inexperienced. And so,
and in shock too, probably.
Yeah, and in shock, right? We had just been sneak attacked. I mean, think about the shock that we were all in after 9/11. I think most of us that are alive today can remember that. At least those of us that are over 30. And imagine, you know, translate that back into an even bigger threat, which is not just a threat of terrorism, but actually a complete invasion. And I just think we were, again, stumbling around trying to get our feet and not really very sharp. And then this thing, about 2:15. This thing is now only 3 or 4 miles off of Santa Monica, and that's when the green alert goes up, which is basically, you know, prepare to fire, and then the city goes black and everything, you know, goes crazy right after that.
Mike, we're coming up on a break, but Bob is in Nevada. He was 5.5 years old when this happened. We're going to check with him right after the break. This is going to be exciting. Can you imagine?
Can't wait. I can't wait to hear this story. This is going to be great.
Plus, I want to talk with you about Men in Black as well and get your take on all of that. Mike Bear with us. Mike, where can people get your latest books?
You can pick them up on Amazon.com, Hidden Agenda, Ancient Aliens and JFK. All those books are out there. And you can also go to AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com, David Hatcher Childress's publishing house, and pick them up there.
David's a good man. Tell him hi for me. Where's the last time I saw you?
The Alien Snowfest in Big Bear.
Exactly. So I love seeing you at all these events all over the place. But we're coming back in a moment. Bob from Nevada, we're going to talk with you. You were a witness at 5.5 years old. We'll be back. Mike Barra with us as we talk about the Battle of Los Angeles. Next moment when we come back with Mike as well, we'll talk about the Men in Black. But we do have a call or two that might have been around during the incredible story 78 years ago. We know Bob in Nevada was 5.5 years old at the time. He's 83.5 now. So we'll get to him, too, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. That's exciting. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Mike Barra. We'll talk about the Men in Black in a moment. Mike is with us talking about the Battle of Los Angeles. Happened about 78 years ago today. Now, we do have Bob in Nevada, who was 5.5 years old in Los Angeles at the time. And, Mike, I want you to join me with this as we chat with Bob. Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, guys, from the great state of Nevada. George, the last time I talked to you, I was on Maui. I'm a developer contractor guy that's winding down his business, and I have a little background on me. For 16 years, right after I got out of college in California, where I was born in Glendale, California, by the way.
Okay.
I became an aerospace engineer for 16 years, and I'm a professional engineer in the state of licensed professional engineer in the state of California, and a general building contractor in Maui, California, and Nevada. So back in the early part of what was it?
1942.
Yeah, 42.
Yeah, right. I remember December 7th. You know, that's when you're real little like that. You start remembering things when you're around 5 years old, and that was such a traumatic day when they bombed Pearl Harbor. I remember my mother was ironing at the ironing board, and she started to cry. She was listening to the radio, and she started to cry, and I said, Mommy, what's wrong? What's wrong? She said, Robbie, what's going on here? You wouldn't understand, but there's some bad people that want to kill us here in California. And I said, what? What's going on? I didn't know much. I just knew that she was crying. And so that was about 2 months before what happened, you know.
And you remember that at 5.5, you have a pretty good memory of this, Bob?
Yes, I do, because it was just, you know, such a intense situation. I was sleeping. It must have been around 1 or 2 in the morning when my mother woke me up and got me out of bed, and there was a man at the door. They called them air raid wardens. Every block, one of the older men that wasn't in the military or hadn't been drafted, they would take turns of being in charge of that block to warn everybody if there was an attack. And he was there at the door. My dad had just opened the door. And he had a steel white helmet on and some kind of an armband. I don't remember the insignia on it, but he told us that all the lights had to be out. In those days, what we had curtains, very thick, heavy curtains that hung over the window so no light would come out.
Right.
And also, my father's car was all taped up except for little slots on the front headlights. Just enough light to where you could barely see the road ahead of you, but you couldn't see anything from the air on that car down below. And so anyway, the railway warden said we were under attack by the Japanese. And all the neighbors were outside on their lawns. Like I said, I was living in Glendale up in the canyon there. And we could look down on the valley below, and we could see the aircraft. It was kind of a cloudy day, if I remember right. I did not see the UFO or whatever it was.
Did you see the 8 lights that they had pointed at this object, Bob?
I do remember seeing what the searchlights or Klieg lights or what we used to call them. And the clouds were all lit up, and I could see the explosions. And
could you hear the concussions?
Oh, yeah. And that was, I think they were coming from Santa Monica area. We could see, you know, we're very close to Hollywood, Glendale is. And so we could see the explosions and hear the noise. You see a flash, and there'd be, you know, a time delay before you hear the noise. And I think the Verdugo Hills, I'm not sure, but I think that there were some fires caused by
When did you finally get to bed, Bob?
Probably didn't. I think we were probably up all night waiting for the attack, you know.
Mike Bera, how much artillery did they fire that night, Michael?
They fired over 1,400 shells. 1,400 shells. Now, that doesn't include the 50 caliber machine gun ammunition, handheld weapons, you know, pistols and rifles and everything else. So it would have been thousands and thousands of rounds of ammo. And also, Bob, you know, a lot of that, the clouds may have been smoke. There were reports of really, really heavy smoke. There were so many shells going off. There was all kinds of smoke coming up. And yeah, I think you're right. Probably fairly high explosive shells. Some of them probably landed in the hills up there because, again, they were firing kind of in all directions. But one thing I wanted to ask you is when you say you saw the searchlights or the Klieg lights, were they focused on one particular object or area, or were they kind of scanning all over the place looking? And did you hear any sounds of aircraft at all?
No, I didn't hear any sound of aircraft, and I thought the lights were kind of moving around. But, you know, it's been so many years ago that it's really hard to remember exactly, but I did remember the lights just moving around in the sky. I don't remember focus, but so you're saying they were focused on the object. I couldn't see the object.
Well, yeah, the ones down on the coastline were. The ones down near the beaches were eventually were focused on one specific object as it kind of traveled down the coast there. But were there lights, like, up in the central part of the city, or were they all out on near the water, or were they all kind of all over the place?
You know, we were from where we were up in the canyon up in Glendale to Santa Monica. My guess is probably 15 miles, maybe 20 miles at the most.
You would have been in kindergarten, maybe first grade at the most, Bob?
I think kindergarten.
Do you remember going into school the next day, or did you even have school the next day?
I don't think we had school that day.
Probably postponed it, I would guess.
Yeah, I think everybody was pretty shook up in all of Southern California at that time. And we were, you know, we were listening to radio. My parents were listening to the radio, trying to hear what was going on. Nobody slept that night. And
do you have any siblings?
No, at that time I didn't. I had a younger brother that was born later, 9 years younger.
Okay, so he missed all the fun.
He missed all the fun, yeah.
That's great. Well, thanks for sharing this with us, Bob. Appreciate it. Mike, isn't that something?
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary, and it just tells you, you know, it sounds like it was completely chaotic that night. And, you know, I understand in the fog of war, in chaos of the time, that people could make mistakes, but I mean, you cannot mistake that photograph. And people have said, well, the photograph was retouched. Well, here's the thing, George. You know, back in those days in the newspapers, every photograph was, quote, retouched before they were put in the paper. And that doesn't mean it was really modified or fabricated. It's not like Photoshop, right? All they could really do was increase or decrease the contrast. That disc-shaped object, that's really there. It's just that what they did is that they enhanced it a little bit, just, you know, on a light table or a light board with the negative to bring out what was there a lot clearer. So, you know, there's no question something really, really extraordinary was in the sky that night.
Well, and the first time I've ever heard of someone coming to the door warning people.
Yeah, there were what they did call air raid wardens, and they were all alerted about 2:25 a.m. So his memory is pretty good. He said 1 or 2 in the morning.
That's pretty good.
About 2:30, yeah.
For a little 5-and-a-half-year-old who's woken up from a dead sleep.
There you go. Yeah, it is. So I think that, you know, if that part of his memory was accurate, then I think we can probably trust the rest of it, too.
Man, because, Michael, I spent the weekend watching you on Ancient Aliens, all about Men in Black. I want to spend a little time asking you your thoughts on Men in Black. What do you think they are?
Well, I've always thought that they were extraterrestrials. You know, I mean, I can picture these guys, these ships coming, you know, landing right smack in the middle of the field, and out pops the black SUV. I assume they've updated from the old 98s that they used to drive, you know, and just coming right out. Because the thing is when they're described as having this white skin and very odd, kind of funny looking faces. And you know, George, I've had two encounters with people that were dressed exactly like Men in Black.
Oh, really? That warned you to like back off?
No, it was really weird. There was one where I was just at dinner down in Huntington Beach. I was at dinner at a restaurant there, a chain restaurant, and there was this guy, an older guy, sitting next to me, two seats over. And he was dressed exactly like a Man in Black with the hat and everything else. And I kind of, you know, I could kind of was looking at him, and I wanted to take a picture. So I snuck my cell phone and took a picture of him. And, you know, I don't know, I was busy with something else, talked to the waitress or whatever. And then the next thing you know, I turned around and he was just gone. He was not there. But when I looked at the picture, his hand was like a claw. It wasn't a human hand. It was really, really weird. So that picture, I got that picture somewhere. I'll have to put it up on my Instagram or something tomorrow. But that was a really weird encounter. And then when I was shooting a show called Uncovering Aliens for Discovery back in 2013, we were in South Carolina, and we looked across this parking lot, and there was a guy dressed exactly like a Man in Black watching every single thing we were doing on that show. And of course, that show was about aliens and UFO sightings. So I've always felt, since I saw those two people, and it's not a very common way to dress, right? All black suit with the hat and the tie. And so I've always felt like they were for real. And my gut feeling tells me that they're definitely extraterrestrials. I don't think they're government agents.
There was a scene, and I was bopping around in my room, that you were on location with a couple other people. Do you remember?
Yeah, that was Maury Island. That's actually we shot that way last year, but that was on Maury Island. Maury Island is adjacent to another major island there called Vashon Island. And the weird thing is, you know, as I grew up in Fontley Hills in Seattle, basically, you know, looking out my window at this whole area and these two islands, and you just take a ferry across. It's a very short trip, about 10 minutes. And Maury Island was kind of, there's a little slough that connects Vashon, and that's where there was this incredible incident back in 1947. I mean, right in sequence, you had the Kenneth Arnold sighting, you had the Maury Island incident, and then you had Roswell. So all within the space of 2 weeks. And Maury Island was a very, very bizarre, very, very bizarre sighting and circumstance. And that was a situation where a man in black showed up, basically told this guy he better stop talking about the incident and what had happened to him. And he later then said, oh, yeah, I made the whole thing up, which I don't think he did, because there's a lot of evidence that it actually happened.
Jeez, it's if they're not extraterrestrials,
mm-hmm.
What agency is sending them? Because this went, the History Channel show went way back to Hoover's days.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, okay, before we know about MJ-12, Majestic 12, right? There's documents that have existed for a long time that the late Stanton Friedman talked about, people that people dug into that prove Majestic 12 existed. But even before that, there's another document that people like Dr. Bob Wood have gone through. It's called the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit Report. And it talks about, among other things, that Congressman John Fitzgerald Kennedy knows about the alien presence. And, of course, I wrote a whole book about that. And it appears that there has been an investigative division of the intelligence agencies before there were even real intelligence agencies. So that would have been back in the 1940s. So I suspect that they worked for that Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, what became MJ-12. So if they were government agents, and I don't think they were, but it's possible, they would have worked for that secret organization, you know, whatever it's morphed into now. We know for a long time it was called MJ-12.
Did they harass pilots and military folks and people like that?
Yeah, those reports are absolutely corroborated. I mean, it goes through all the history of ufology. I mean, there are people that have written entire books about the Men in Black and just all the different encounters. And here's the weird thing, too, is that they have not only been associated with aliens and UFO sightings and landings and crashes at Roswell and stuff like that. They've also been associated with weird cryptozoological stuff, Bigfoot sightings, and this is the one that really gets me, the Mothman prophecy.
That's right. They talked about that.
Yeah, they were like suppressing people that had seen the Mothman. So it seems like whatever they are, whatever their organization is all about, the purpose is to keep people from believing or being interested in anything to do with the paranormal. I mean, I don't think we've had any ghost visitation you know, Men in Black reports, but that's about the only thing. I mean, basically, you know, or it could indicate also, George, that, that the Mothman is actually some sort of extraterrestrial.
That's right.
Also,
that's right.
You know,
have the Men in Black reportedly ever hurt anybody physically?
Well, I don't know. That there are reports of people disappearing, you know, after being told by the Men in Black to shut up, and then they didn't shut up. So there are a few cases like that, but I don't know. You know, did the people just choose to go off the radar? You know, I mean, by all accounts, these people are pretty scary. I mean, the thing is, the guy that came and talked to the Maury Island incident witness, whose name escapes me at the moment, you know, he was intimidated to the point that he later denied that he'd ever had the accident. And, I mean, there are people who said, you know, that, you know, one of the parts of the incident at Maury Island was that his dog got killed by some of the falling debris. And, you know, there were people that said, yeah, you had a dog. And then after that week, the dog was, we never saw the dog again. So, you know, it appears that they have been pretty effective in suppressing people. So at the very least, they're very threatening and very scary. I mean, look, if you're an extraterrestrial, you're working for a government agency, and some guy is talking, especially back in the 50s when everything, 40s and 50s, when everything was so paranoid, you know, I don't think they were at all above just, you know, picking people up and doing the Jimmy Hoffa with them.
Exactly. Could it have been Harold Dahl, one of the witnesses?
Yeah, Harold Dahl, right, yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. So, you know, so, I mean, again, there does seem to be this consistent history of them at least threatening people, and who knows, maybe carrying out some of these threats.
Mike's Blogspot, of course, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Some of his books include Ancient Aliens and JFK, Lightbringer, Dark Mission as well. And, of course, Mike Barra will be with us when we come back in a moment to take phone calls on Men in Black, the Battle of Los Angeles, or other UFO stories. What would you say, Mike? We've got the 15 seconds left, but what's your biggest expertise in this field? What would you say?
That's interesting, because I'm pretty general. I'm really a generalist, but I think it has to go back to the roots. It has to go back to ancient alien civilizations on other planets, on Mars, on the moon. That's what I'm really the top, you know, really on top of. And then the really weird sort of Egyptian religious conspiracy stuff that seems to go on inside NASA. There's a lot of weird symbolism.
There sure is. We'll be back with calls with Mike Barra next on Coast to Coast AM.